Good morning. Welcome to the Ag Market Network monthly teleconference. It is September the 13th. We want to thank our sponsor, Bayer, for making this program possible. We would also want to thank our sponsors. Dr. John Robinson is our lead speaker today, and he'll be joined by Kip Butts, and also Gerald Nieper will be with us. OA is out of the country. I do not believe he'll be with us today. So let's go ahead and get started. John, thanks for leading us off today.
Thank you, Pat, and good morning to everybody. So I'm going to summarize our WASDE report from yesterday, which was a bit of a surprise, not so much in the report itself, in the month-on-month changes or the resulting levels of supply and demand variables, but perhaps it was the surprise was in the unexpected direction of some of the changes, which apparently caught analysts' predictions wrong, and we saw a market reaction in response to that. And I'm going to focus the bulk of what I say about the U.S. numbers. So let me just get to the world part of it and get it out of the way. The world numbers, there were only minor changes really to the ending stocks. I would characterize the world, the new numbers for the world or for the foreign numbers as basically neutral in their effect. We had some reductions in foreign carry-in that were pretty much offset by some increases in foreign production and then some very minor changes to the consumption and trade numbers. But as I say, the end result was basically treading water. I wouldn't expect much market reaction from that, except for the fact that perhaps some people were expecting another decline in world-ending stocks, maybe a reduction in production in India or something like that. People have been watching for that sort of thing, and because perhaps they didn't see that, it might have been surprising. But basically no real change in the numbers. The U.S. side saw more changes in the monthly supply and demand number, so let me focus on that. There were a number of, again, not drastic changes. First of all, again, carry-in from the previous marketing year was reduced 100,000 bales. Production was increased a little over a quarter of a million bales. Mill use was cut 100,000 bales, and so when you finish all the slight tinkering, the bottom line is a 200,000 bale increase in projected ending stocks. Now, just sizing that up just on face value, I'd say that's mildly bearish. You know, nothing to be terrified of. But the market had a decidedly different reaction to that. We were down 2 cents at one point yesterday, down about 3%. And so when you look at what the expected, the analysts who get polled by the media, what they were expecting to see was, perhaps a little more production, but certainly people were not expecting a cut in mill use, I don't think, and they were expecting an increase in U.S. exports, which wasn't realized. Export number was left alone. So instead of whittling away at the ending stocks estimate from the August report, they added to it, and it was that flip-flopping of against expectations, I think, that caused a bearish reaction. So again, not so much the month-over-month change or the levels, but just the surprise there. Now, the aspect of the U.S. report that really caught my focus was the production number, and ordinarily we pay a lot of attention to that in the August report and the September reports, because those are benchmarks where USDA is for the first time going out and basing their yield and production numbers on field sampling. And the September report can be very influential in that it will either confirm or sometimes contradict what was first measured back in August, and that can be significant when you have a typically younger West Texas crop that's maturing out there, and you go back out in September and see, have things changed, have fruiting forms, are they still there, have they matured, is a big crop getting bigger, or vice versa, that sort of thing. So the September report can be influential in that regard. What's really struck me about this report was that it was such a sort of a mishmash of opposing forces and offsets. We had increases and decreases across lots of states with no real clear clear intuition that would have led me to expect some of the changes that I saw. First of all, there were changes in harvested acres, which some of that was revising planted acres, I think, from FSA. That led to some, and that probably drove some of the biggest changes that we saw in production. There was a cluster of states, Texas being the largest, with 200,000 more harvested acres, and then a cluster of other states, Alabama, Oklahoma, California, Arkansas, South Carolina, Tennessee, New Mexico, Kansas, so from across the entire belt, not just neighboring states, that saw smaller increases in harvested acres, and a lot of those were also matched up with increases in yield, small increases in projected yield, but that added up to increased bales. Of that group, Texas had a 304,000 bale increase month over month in projected production, and then all those other states that I read off added up to 309,000. So two big chunks, adding up to a 600,000 positive adjustment in estimated production. A fairly big swing, not certainly within the historical standards. If you look back at history, what USDA projects in August for the USDA cotton production number can vary historically. On average, it's about 6%. That number can vary from the August-based number to what the final number is. So there's a lot of room for variation here, and we're well within that historical adjustment. But you have this 600,000 bale increase, and then that's offset by, again, a cluster of other states that are not necessarily neighboring states, which most of those states saw reductions due to, with one or two exceptions, a small reductions in harvested acres, like Mississippi was down 100,000 acres, and so was North Carolina, and so was Louisiana, and so was, 10,000 in North Carolina, 10,000 in Louisiana, 15,000 in Missouri, 110,000 in Georgia. That was the big one in that group. Some, but not all, of those same states were matched up with decreases in yield, small, except in the case of Virginia, which had a 282-pound reduction month over month in yields. So there's the clear, I guess, storm damage effect from what was in the news in the last few weeks being reflected in this report. Anyway, that wound up with a reduction in projected production in those states of like 200,000 bales in Georgia, and smaller amounts in the other states. It added up to 300-something thousand. And so you had 600 more in one place and 300-something thousand less in another place, and the net of all that up and down and offsets, the net of all that was a 263,000 bale increase. But it's coming from such a mishmash of, you know, going up here and going down there and not necessarily clear why. I mean, some of those southeastern states actually had increases in their yield in the September report compared to August. I wouldn't have expected that given the rain, but Georgia was up, South Carolina was up, North Carolina was up. It leaves me not really seeing any kind of trend to develop an expectation about where production may be headed. You know, I don't see a big crop going bigger. I don't see a small crop getting smaller. I see a whole bunch of different adjustments in a lot of different places and being driven a lot by the acreage change, which I don't expect that to happen again. So going forward, I don't have a strong feeling for making a call about what might happen that would really increase our production. Again, I don't really see a big crop getting bigger scenario or a small crop getting smaller scenario. The one exception to that might be Texas, and that is because out in the northwestern part of the state, that's probably be true of Oklahoma and Kansas too, we've got a crop that still has some potential. You know, the recent rain isn't doing any good, but the irrigated crops and the later maturing crops, if they have the Indian summer that they need to mature out some of the yield potential, the potential's there if they have the time. And so just in that region, I think in the ensuing supply and demand reports, we could see some increase from there, maybe 100,000, 200,000 more bales possibly just coming out of that region. But from the other places in the country and the other places in the belt, I don't have a basis for thinking that there's going to be big changes in the production number going forward. And so that sort of leaves me thinking that there may not be much potential for a big price response due to big production changes going forward. I think we're sort of getting set for what we have. Certainly there's, you know, again, historically there's room still for more change, but I can't predict that based on just what we've had so far. It's really hard to see with the mishmash of offsetting changes what might develop from that, other than maybe some increased production coming out of the Southwest if they get the Indian summer that they need. So the only other thing I'd comment on is quality. You know, we've had a bunch of late season rain. It's certainly degraded quality in some places, like the early new crop that comes out of South Texas is taking a hit. You know, lent quality, and they've lost the value of a lot of cottonseed. And that may be happening in a few other places in the Southeast, too. That, to me, sounds like a setup for the kind of year that we've seen in the last few years where there may be a shortage of good premium grades, good color grades from lint getting rained on and cottonseed sprouting and high leaf and stuff like that. So whereas I don't really see the basis for a big change in base grade prices, we might still be in that kind of situation where there's an oversupply of lower grade stuff that will get pretty strongly discounted, and then if you're one of the ones that has good premium grades, you'll be seeing some good premiums in the market on top of that. So it may, you know, the sub markets for quality may be acting pretty strongly, whereas I don't really see a whole lot of potential for a huge, you know, supply response, price response, due to, you know, the expectation of what we're going to produce. I think we're getting close to what we're going to have there. So that kind of leaves me with my price projection. Last month, I think I was, you know, picking a 10-cent possible range, and I think I was 64 to 74. And I'm not sure I would change that. I might say 63 to 73 just to allow for the possibility of some hedge fund unloading and pushing prices down a bit. Then again, I've seen a few positive things, and we can talk about this more, a few positive indicators with our export sales at the levels that they've been, given prices at this, you know, in the mid to upper 60s. So I'll stick my price projection about 63.73 for the December contract, and we'll see how the rest of this uncertainty unfolds. So, Pat, that was pretty much it.
All right. You've mentioned exports. We've seen very good exports. Gerald, what are your thoughts on these exports? Can they continue? Can we continue to see what we've been seeing?
Pat, I think so. I just got back into town Friday. I'd been out of the country for a couple of weeks visiting a number of countries, and I can tell you there's a good appetite out there. Now, are they willing to pay really high prices to get their hands on cotton? No, but there's a very good appetite for cotton out there. And so, yes, I don't see any reason, at least in the near term, why these export sales numbers won't continue to impress. And 11.5 million bale export number that USDA came out with, I don't know why people would be disappointed by USDA not going up this month. I mean, 11.5 million bales is a lot of damn cotton to sell and to ship in a crop year. And so you're going to have to see over time, that, you know, continually good export sales. Even though we've made great progress, and if you look at the numbers, we only have to average about 140 or 50,000 bales a week in sales to assure ourselves to get up to 11.5 million bales. It is so early in the season to jump to the conclusion that we're going to, you know, immediately jump higher. I'm having trouble with that rationale, but I suppose I can see why people might be disappointed. But it certainly wasn't a surprise that they didn't raise the export sales number at this point in time. But I do think that we'll continue to see good export sales as we go forward. And you know, unless things come to a standstill in the world, and I suppose they could, but right now things look pretty healthy.
Gerald, if you don't mind, excuse me, I've been a little surprised at how strong the export sales were, too, and you mentioned that there's a strong appetite out there for cotton. I've been watching these yarn prices, and they're just not appreciating at the level I would have expected. Is there a disconnect there right now? Are you following that? Did you see any change, or am I missing something on those yarn prices?
Definitely there's disappointment with yarn prices. You know, if anything, the textile mills are more disappointed with New York coming down than anybody, because, you know, they were just getting their yarn prices back up with this recent rise in New York, and now New York falls out of bed, and it's just like, damn, you know. So the mills would prefer to see New York, you know, show some stabilization and probably actually even climb a little bit, so they can justify getting their yarn prices to stabilize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd seen the yarn prices as being a problem for cotton to maintain higher levels, particularly with polyester at the prices it is. So thanks for that. I'm wondering if we can maintain the export level. To your point, it's early in the year, unless we get a little bit more support out of the yarn prices.
All right, let's talk about a group that's very influential in cotton prices, and that's the large speculators. We touched on this a little bit earlier. I would ask Kip, what is the commitment of traders show, and the commitment of traders basically reveals the size of the speculators in the market. What do you see there, Kip?
Well, I was looking at it earlier, and we spoke just briefly before the call. The large spec, the futures and options net position, I look at this as their net position as a percentage of total open interest. And it expanded from 26% to 26.8% in the most recent report. For the large spec, and the managed money position moved from 19.1 to 19.6. Neither of these are quote record levels over full history, but they're very long for this time of the year, and certainly larger than the last 5 years for this time of the year. So these traders have a pretty strong commitment to a long position here. Should they decide, for whatever reason, to come out of this market, we could see, and that doesn't mean it's going to be long-term, but we could get a sharp spike down should they get some signal to tell them they need to be out.
Well, you know, a lot of these funds are technically oriented. I'm just wondering what level causes some of these people to get a little bit spooked below us. I mean, how low? What level have we got to take out to the downside in any one of our group that where we could start seeing some of this liquidation?
Pat, you know, I don't even know if the word technically motivated is even appropriate at points in time. Because yesterday, you know, you had a 2-minute time period. I mean, shit, people were just barely able to look at a headline, and the market trades 4,000 contracts, and it sends the market down. So you've got these algorithms out there. You know, they read a headline, and maybe it says U.S. stocks go from 4.7 to 4.9, and boom, they just start selling. So you don't know what's setting these guys off, because certainly from a technical perspective between, you know, really even a fundamental perspective from 900 to 902, not much had changed. I mean, the numbers were pretty vanilla, if you ask me, but I suppose a 200,000 barrel increase in U.S. ending stocks was deserving of a 4,000 contract sell-off in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. Well,
you make a good point.
Impression.
I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was just going to say, my impression, just in what few interactions I have with people in the fund sector and then other people that I talk to that work with people in the fund sector, it seems like there's a wide variety of expertise, I'd say agronomic expertise, real-world perspective on what should be driving fundamentals amongst that sector and those analysts. Some of them are the most sophisticated people in the world. And some of them are mathematically and statistically in their modeling. And then I hear other people doing the rationale for some of their position taking just doesn't make any sense. So I think it's just the whole gamut. It'd be hard to predict them as a group because I think there's a wide range of ability and motivation there. But you can see what they did to the market. You know, back up. Kip, I don't know what the position was, but, I mean, at its height in July, or late July, early August, we shot up, you know, futures were up to 78, and that was a big fluctuation higher than where we are now in that hedge fund position that ran us up to there. And then, you know, we ran up 12 cents and down 10, and you can track the hedge fund positioning that took us up there and then took us out. So, I mean, they're pretty influential on our volatility, for sure.
Well, I agree with what you're saying as far as their sophistication and across the board, but there seems to be a herd mentality involved with this too. These guys are speculative, and they get a position on, and they want to ride a trend. You had asked a question about where they might want to start getting out. And with if you take December, I think, to these recent lows around this 65.5 or so, I think you're going to get some of these guys decide, okay, I've had enough of this. And we might see a little spike down there. Again, this doesn't mean you're going to stay down very long necessarily, but you've got to give these guys some room to get out. As you mentioned a moment ago, you get a 12-cent swing one way or the other. These guys get in and they do that, and they get out and do the same thing. They really don't, although they may have a lot of sophistication in dealing with the market, they're not going to sit there and take a loss if they can avoid it. They're just going to.
Yeah.
There's a lot of herd mentality involved in that.
And I would think that I think Gerald's one to point this out at this meeting every time I'm coming away thinking about it. But the 200-day move average is about 64 something, and I can't help but think there's a heck of a lot of stops orders right clustered around there. That if it got down to there, there'd be a little extra jet fuel getting them out, and then we'd probably overreact and then start coming back. So somewhere around right there.
All right. I asked Kelly Merritt, who oftentimes joins us, to give kind of her view, and she emailed me how she sees as she talks to people in the area of West Texas, how they see the crop. And I want to read it and just get some comments here. And she says it's really too early to know what the wet weather has done, and we're forecast to have more rain all week. Quality won't be affected too much so far, but quality is definitely a question. Defoliants will start going out in the next couple of weeks. And she comments under the irrigated cotton. She says 50% of the crop is very good, two bales and better. 30% of the irrigated is good, which would be, she says, a bale and a half. And then 20% of the irrigated is going to probably be about a bale. That's under irrigated. Under the dry land, she's breaking it down into 25% increments. She says 25% of the dry land is good, which would be one bale. 25% of the dry land would be three-quarters of a bale. 25% of the dry land would be a half bale. And 25% of the crop would be a quarter of a bale and less. And she says, of course, most of that won't be harvested. And so she just sent that out last night. I mean, any thoughts? Is that about what people thought? Is that how does that sound to you, John, or
yeah,
Gerald?
That pretty much, I could believe that based on what I've heard. You know, people are hopeful out there. Most of the reactions to the rain, you know, the dry land being further along and close to cutout, if not there, it hadn't been hurt. If it's not, you know, cracking and opening up, but it hadn't been hurt by this rain, but it hadn't done anything for it, whereas these rains in August had probably some potential to maybe do some benefit, provided they have the time in this month and in October to mature out some of those bowls. But, you know, their hope, the feeling out there is hopeful.
You know, I'm just curious. Of course, some of that crop is fairly late, you know, in West Texas, and I haven't seen any weather forecast, but historically, isn't the first freeze possible somewhere around, you know, the 10th of October? And if so, is anybody seen a projection whether or not that's maybe could happen earlier this year or later this year? And what made me think about it is when I walked outside this morning, it's quite cool here in the San Joaquin Valley. and maybe it's just a short-term phenomenon, but I started thinking about that this morning.
Yeah, I haven't heard any specific forecast of freeze dates for this year, but, I mean, the possibility is there for it to happen in October. And, you know, I think the whole industry where the acreage expanded above Amarillo and expanded in Kansas, all that has sort of been in a warmer-than-normal a warmer-than-normal kind of time. We haven't had a lot of those early freezes. They haven't been chopped off at the knees the way, you know, it could happen. It could happen any time.
Okay. Well, you know, we got a lot of farmers that listen to our broadcast, and after hearing all this, many of them will say, okay, so what should I look to do? And any recommendations or thoughts on John, for what farmers should look to do here with this market?
Yeah, they should have hedged or sold in the last week of July. But since they can't do that, you know, I've looked at a few. I'm tracking a 70. They could look at put spreads right now. There are some that are fairly affordable. I with the time of the year, the value would be running out on those things, and they probably ought to be looking at March if they're concerned about the downside. But you know, I don't know that realistically with December not I don't really see it going too much lower than the mid 60s. I'd really question the worth of spending extra at this point.
So a level above us that they might consider. I mean, you were talking about 73 is your upside. I mean, if we were to get a bounce into that,
yeah. If it went back up to there, I would probably at least be shopping for, you know, at the money puts and selling a mid to upper 60s put underneath it.
Okay. Anybody else got any thoughts on that?
We're kind of in a real no man's land right here at 67 cents, roughly. I think if we were to, it's hard to tell a grower to sell right now, unless you just felt like for sure this thing was going to completely crap out, and I just don't think it's going to completely go down the toilet right now. But certainly it's going to, I don't think we've seen the last of 65 cents. And I think it's 65 cents. We'll probably see 65 before we see 72 again. But I think if we were to fall to 65 cents, I'd be looking at buying a call and then just being patient with your marketing until we got back up above 70 cents. Because I don't think we've seen the last of 72 or 73 cents either.
Okay.
Well, you know, I kind of like what both these guys had to say. I do think there's a bit of upside potential on this. I'm a bit concerned more that I think people need to be pretty adept if this thing moves up around 70 or 72 cents and not be afraid just to get things done there. I'd get some cotton hedge because I'm fearful that we may have overestimated world consumption, although Gerald said earlier that the demand is a lot better and the export numbers tell us that these countries are ready to buy some cotton. But it just, with the polyester prices where they are and the spec position where it is, I think it's just going to be pretty difficult to hold higher levels without something happening. Now, if we find out that there's a supply problem in India or one of the major producing countries, that's a different deal. My bias is that the U.S. crop may wind up being a little bit bigger than it is now, and that's as much gut, I guess, as anything. I have seen some numbers that suggest that Texas could have a slightly higher yield, although John's done an excellent job of telling us what his thoughts are on that. So I'm a little bit, I'm not quite as bullish, I think, as John and Gerald are, at least not today. I reserve the right to change my mind, of course.
No, you can't.
Anybody else got any other thoughts before we go through and kind of give everybody's price forecast? Okay. John, you've kind of mentioned it, but go over to...
Pardon me, there is one thing I want to bring up. I don't know. We may have talked about this previously, but in the cotton market, I think we've had a scenario where, you know, this well-spun company in India got caught using something other than Egyptian cotton, and Target department store, you know, quit doing, or at least, excuse me, stopped doing business with them on the bed linens. Walmart has done the same thing. In the long haul, I think this could be very, very good for U.S. cotton if, in fact, we do find there's one company, I think, that's doing some DNA testing and puts a marker on this cotton. I think there's a way to market U.S. cotton and actually provide some value in the marketing chain if we can sort of identify this. I think this has been done in Texas. I think they've got what they call a Lone Star marker or something. I think this is kind of a big deal. If we can do that and have traceability on this where people feel assured that they're getting what's being advertised, I think that will help the demand for U.S. I don't know what you guys think. I think this may be a bigger deal than has been advertised. Do y'all have any thoughts on that? Apparently not.
Yeah, no.
Gerald, have you thought about that at all? Have you had any feedback from anybody on it?
No. The only feedback I guess I got was there seems to be more interest in the BCI labeled cotton than there was, let's say, this time a year ago or even 6 months ago. I've vacillated on the BCI registration for growers going through the process of getting audited. I've been back and forth on it for a number of reasons. You know, the biggest reason, of course, is I'm not sure why the U.S. has to go through this auditing process since we are the most regulated country in the world. You know, I think we employ the best practices in terms of cotton production. And, you know, per acre use of chemicals and or water of any place in the world, and yet, you know, they're asking growers to go out and pay some third-party verifier to verify that. It is a label. The retailers are starting to do the pull-through through the supply chain, and there's definitely more interest in BCI cotton than I anticipated. So, you know, from that perspective, I think if the U.S. has more BCI registered cotton, you know, it will help because, by and large, you know, these mills prefer to buy U.S. cotton. Even if they have to pay a little bit more, generally because of the contamination issues, there's less here in the U.S. and which reminds me of other things. I mean, these round modules with the yellow wrap, and I know Jenner's try. Everyone tries their best to keep the yellow wrap out of the ginning process, but can't emphasize enough how much more. How much it hurts when you know customers start showing you know pictures of yellow wrap in the bales, and it's just a problem. I mean it's just going to happen, but it doesn't make the mills feel any better about it when they get it. But to stay vigilant and try to do the best to keep the yellow wrap from going through the ginning process.
So you, but do you think it's worthwhile to be doing what you need to do to be able to have the BCI?
I do think it's worthwhile. You know, is there a premium? Not much of one. There seems to be a willingness to pay a little bit more for BCI from some customers. Other customers, they don't want to pay a premium. Would like to have a discussion with BCI that maybe, you know, as far as how BCI charges, because BCI doesn't just charge the grower. They charge the textile mill. They charge all throughout the supply chain. And, you know, mills are saying, look, we're already paying BCI. Why should we pay a premium to the grower? Well, maybe BCI ought to charge a little less to the mill so that they can pass on a premium to the grower to entice the grower to actually go through the process. But I think there's ways to limit the cost on growers. Let's say that there's, you know, half a dozen growers in a relatively small geographic area. You know, you can get one third-party verifier to come in and verify everyone, and everybody can split the cost. Essentially, what you're paying is a hotel room, travel fare for a guy to come down there, and I guess some small fee. But there are ways to lessen the expense to the grower. As I was traveling and listening to folks, yes, BCI seems to be catching some critical mass.
Okay. Well, John, back to you on your price forecast. How high we can go? How low we can go? Tell us your levels again.
I would say 63 to 73, incorporating, you know, uncertainties and just possibilities into a 10-cent range.
Okay, Kip, what are your levels?
Yeah, I'm going to be just a little lower than that and say maybe 61 to 71, 72. I got to expand my range a little bit, but I'm thinking we could take this market a little lower than what John's thinking.
Okay, Gerald, what are your levels?
You know, I can't argue with either one of those. What makes me think that we won't or will have difficulty falling that far is just the fact that we are selling a lot of cotton. Merchants are going to need to get their hands on cotton, and I think it'll be very difficult to buy cotton from growers if we go down to 61 to 62 cents. There's a lot of cotton that's on call from textile mills, and I think that they're all thinking, you know, 61 to 63 cents, and a lot of times that just doesn't happen when everybody's thinking roughly the same number. So I would be probably a 64, 65 cents on the low side to 74 to 75 cents on the high side.
Okay. Any other comments before we wrap up here? Okay. Well, we want to thank our sponsors, Bayer, for making our program possible. Also, special thanks to Dr. John Robinson for leading us off today, and to Kip Butts and Gerald Nieper for being with us. Thanks to you, our listeners, and that concludes this meeting of the Ag Market Network. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth.